Esto. All my life I've been searching for a path that allows me to be having a shit ton of fun while disrupting the patriarchy.
I live in this country now. I'm called by this name. I speak this language. It's not quite the same. For no other reason than this, it's my home. And the places I used to be, far from are gone. You've traveled this long, you just have to go on. Don't even look back to see how far you've come. Though your body is bending under the load, there is nowhere to stop anywhere on this road. Afraid of me, he believes if he doesn't stand guard with a knife, I'll make him my slave for the rest of his life. I love this hour when the tide is just turning. There will be an end. If I can stand up to angels and men, I'll never get swallowed in darkness again.
Hi everyone, this is She Believed She Could So She Did, and you are listening to Radio Laura. This week again on a different format than usual, I would like to propose to you not only music, but also the second part of the podcast of Kelly Hayes about conflict transformation. Approaching the 14th of June, which in Switzerland means feminist strike, and considering that I am absolutely not good in facing conflicts, I thought that not only I, but also other people could benefit from the tools and the suggestion of the podcast of Kelly Hayes and guests Arati Kasturi Rangan and Rebecca Subar, both members of the Flying Dragons Collective. Get inspired. Till next time.
Welcome to Movement Memos, a Truth Out podcast about organizing, solidarity, and the work of making change. I'm your host, writer and organizer, Kelly Hayes. In this episode, we'll be delving further into one of the book's themes by talking about conflict and movement spaces, how it can disrupt our work as organizers, and how we can find our way through it. One of the reasons our groups and formations are so vulnerable to conflict is that as human beings, many of us are deeply traumatized by white supremacy and capitalism. We have been forced into survival mode and pitted against each other in order to succeed or even survive. Unfair dynamics have sometimes conditioned us to fight or flee rather than deploying skills we've never had the chance to cultivate. The truth is, when we are empowered to resolve conflicts constructively, we pose a greater threat to authority and the system. Our cultivation of these skills of cooperation is not in the system's best interest. So it's no surprise that the state or the labor market present us with few opportunities to learn such lessons. Our alienation from one another strengthens the system and our enemies. The emotional beatings we take in this society due to ignorance, cruelty, self-absorption, or poor communication skills can leave us battered in ways that make us incredibly reactive when we feel harmed. I know I struggled with this for years, and I sometimes still do. When we get accustomed to operating in defensive and survival modes that have seemed to work for us in the past, it can be very hard to shift gears when we are trying to create a more just world, one where our defensiveness, evasion, and aggression might not be the best responses. But we are wounded people, and being injured ingrains particular responses. Our minds apply the lessons of survival, deploying tactics that have worked, or at least made us feel better, in the past, without necessarily evaluating the needs or wants of ourselves or others in the present. As Miriam and I write in Let This Radicalize You, traumas abound in our society, and the many disasters ahead are sure to leave an ever greater number of people feeling traumatized. Navigating a crisis, or even a misstep by an organizer or activist, is much more difficult with unchecked trauma responses ricocheting around a room. Many of the social patterns and behaviors that lead us to reject one another and revert to individualism are the products of trauma. So to do the work of being human together, we must make space to address these emotional and physiological realities. Grief work, healing work, and conflict resolution have always been important to our movements. A strong organizing community is more than a labor force for social justice. It is an ecosystem of care, learning, relationship building, and action. Today, we are talking about the work of conflict transformation and how organizers can position themselves to do that work. My Truth Out colleague Sam Borak and I had the opportunity to attend a month-long workshop series exploring the In It Together toolkit. The toolkit was created by Interrupting Criminalization, an organization Miriam co-founded, and Dragonfly Partners. Dragonfly Partners is a group that helps client partners transform their internal cultures and structures to build effective social change strategies. The In It Together toolkit provides a step-by-step diagnostic tool to assess conflict in movement-building organizations and groups and provide strategies, tools, and resources to transform that conflict. The toolkit was written by Arthi Kusturi-Rungan and Sarah Jaffe of Dragonfly Partners, with contributions from Miriam Kaba. I cannot recommend this resource highly enough, and I really believe that if more of our groups took this wisdom on board, our movements would be strengthened in ways that are difficult for a lot of us to even imagine right now. I hear from people on a regular basis that their groups are in a rut and mired in conflict, or worse, that their organization or their latest project has already been torn apart by conflict. In this episode, we are going to explore some ideas that might help us get out of those ruts and discuss a tool that could help many of us rethink or recreate our approaches to conflict in ways that can help keep our groups strong. We will be hearing from Arthi Kusturi-Rungan and Rebecca Subar, who are members of Dragonfly Partners, about the lessons of the In It Together toolkit and how we can build healthy cultures of accountability in our movement spaces.
I will tell
Something in the toolkit that really resonated with me was a question about whether people in our groups tend to talk directly to the people they are upset with, or whether we are more likely to raise the concern with someone else. The answer to that question tells us so much about what may be lacking in the social ecosystem of our groups and why we may be stuck or at risk of getting stuck in conflicts. It's not always easy to address people directly when we are upset. And if we have not done the work of building understanding or skills to address those moments in a good way, our efforts can easily go off the rails. But the question of who we are talking to when we are upset and whether or not it's the person we're upset with can tell us a lot about the work we may need to do in our groups in order to build a culture where healthy conflicts and conflict transformation are possible.
Direct communication and feedback are critical tools in our conflict transformation toolkit. One of the major sources of conflict in our group is the assumptions that we make about other people's intentions, the meaning behind other people's actions, or the assumption that whatever it is that we want or we need is plain, it is visible just because we feel it so strongly. We expect each other to be mind readers in ways that are really unhelpful and also just really unrealistic, particularly given that we are often working in groups that are a mix of people, some of whom are, you know, have been targeted by systems of oppression, others who've benefited from systems of oppression. So many different ways, cultures and identities and experience that really bring us to different places, even within the same thing happening. And, you know, I think that the practice of direct communication starts with taking that beat first before jumping to some conclusion to really settle yourself, get clear on what your own intent is, what's your goal in speaking directly with someone or giving someone some feedback. What is the specific thing you want to address? You know, we can tend to talk in generalities. We can tend to be really vague. And we do this sometimes thinking that if we're direct and specific, we're going to hurt somebody's feelings. But actually, when we're being vague, then we aren't giving people the information they need to be able to actually change their behaviors in ways that are going to support your being in it together, right? So really getting specific about the behavior that was problematic or the impact that that behavior had on you or on the work or on other people, including the feelings, what feelings happened, because we need to get better at understanding, right, our impact on other people and to also be understanding of one another's feelings and to make space for those feelings and know that we can still manage that, navigate that, and come out on the other side. In fact, that's how trust is built. We often think that, you know, we have to say all the right things and do all the right things and never say anything to anybody that could be critical because we don't want to hurt them or because that way we're not going to mess up. But trust building requires risk, and we need trust inside our movement groups and direct communication and feedback where we can sit with somebody and tell them and speak to them as opposed to about them with other people. And that's something that we see a lot in the groups that we work with, that people are speaking about one another, like so-and-so really pissed me off when they did XYZ. Well, did you talk to them about it? No, you know, I didn't have the time, or I don't know, they probably won't take it the right way, or whatever it is. We make a lot of excuses, and that's part of our conflict avoidance. That's part of that white normed culture, that niceness that Rebecca was referring to, that can really prevent us from moving through the conflict and coming out on the other side, often stronger, often with able to work together better, often with more trust. And so we really encourage people to muster their courage to give that direct feedback and also to receive feedback. That's part of what we don't often talk about is some of us are really bad at receiving feedback. We take it personally, or we feel like we are the worst person in the world. You know, we might fall really quickly into blame, self-blame and shame, or on the other end to completely being defensive and angry rather than just receiving the information. And so again, that also requires some of that self-regulation that will allow us to receive feedback and consider it and think about it, right? Ah, I didn't realize I had this impact on someone. What could I do differently? You know? So this is why we think this is one of the most important tools in the toolbox, direct communication and feedback.
I'm on the other side. 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 I'm on the other side.
What does it look like to create healthy mechanisms for conflict transformation?
If you're going to become an organization, a group, a community, a pair of people who are committed to conflict transformation, you're going to change some of your habits. You're going to learn certain tools. What are you going to do? What mechanisms are going to actually help you to do these transformations? Well, I'm part of an online group that meets once a month, and we have goals. We set goals and we try to support each other to meet whatever those goals might be. And the reason we do that is because it's really hard to change your behavior. And most of the time I want to do things take a walk every day or go to sleep on time. And those are some of the commitments that I make to myself. We wouldn't have groups like that. We wouldn't have struggles trying to make our life align with our intentions for our life, unless that was a hard thing for people to do. And it is a difficult thing for most of us to do. And so we've got to practice it. And many of us in movement space use that word for any number of things that we want to practice. And I don't feel comfortable advising us to actually make a commitment to doing some big thing that's different than what we do now, even though we kind of have to. But what I think we can do is we can study together and we can debrief the conflicts that we have and study in that way and just talk about them and shift our understanding by having a regular practice of after conflict reviews, if you want to call them that. We're studying specific aspects of conflict that can give us some wisdom and insight. So for example, we might invite ourselves to look at power, to look at the power dynamics inside our groups one of our norms. Did you mention this one, Arthi, was to like to name and discuss power? What is it exactly? It's to name our power dynamics and deal with them and do good things with them. I should have our norms memorized and I don't. And studying power in the group and being able to distinguish power dynamics inside our groups, where all of us presumably are longing for transformation and we want to do the work to put right power relations in place. We need to distinguish those power dynamics from the power dynamics out in the world, where we campaign against our targets and against fossil fuels and white supremacy culture and bad healthcare and terrible education systems and deep and dramatic economic inequality. We have to use different tools than we use out in the world. And one of the ways to do that is to be aware of power dynamics in the group, be able to discuss them. It humanizes the conversation about power dynamics. And it, I believe, makes the group less likely to use tools intended to harm or to bring down another, which we would do out in the world in campaigning, from tools which are meant to hold each other accountable with dignity and with respect and with care. And finally, one of the most important tools for conflict transformation is practicing curiosity. Now, when we meet periodically and we do an after conflict review, we're paying attention to things we might not have paid attention to before, and that engenders and encourages curiosity. The source of my own curiosity, I believe, first of all, comes from being fourth of four kids in a household where I saw a lot, I experienced a lot. I kind of know what was happening uprank from me, right? Because I was the youngest. I saw a lot of things go down with my three older siblings. And that was a root of curiosity. But also, I made a big transition in my life at age 25. I had grown up in a family that still practices Orthodox Judaism and with very strict rules. And I was married to a man, an Orthodox rabbi. And at 25, I took my two babies and I left that marriage and I stopped being religious. And I came out as a big old queer, as I said earlier. I was non-binary from age 3, but it took till I was 25 in 1985 to leave the life that I was born into. And by doing that, the combination maybe of being the youngest and maybe being a Jew in the world, but specifically of being a genderqueer person. When I came out in 1985, it was as a lesbian feminist. And that queerness that I experienced enabled me to always constantly have around me the awareness that what one perceives because of how they were raised.